I'm here with Rick Bardou, who is a lead engineer at the Liquity project, which is a stable coin, but also a borrowing protocol project. I believe it falls under the category of DeFi, so decentralized finance. And that's also why I named this stream Truly Decentralized Money. Rick, welcome. Thank you very much for coming on to the Money and Macro channel. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about the Liquity project that you're working so hard on? And basically, yeah, what it is, and also like, why do we need Liquity? What's the use of Liquity?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, thanks, Jerry. It's really great to be here. Great to be on your show. So Liquity is a decentralized borrowing system. It's based on the Ethereum blockchain. It allows people to borrow funds against their Ether collateral. Ether is this native cryptocurrency on the Ethereum blockchain. Mm-hmm. And many people who hold Ether are bullish on it, and they expect the price to appreciate over time. So obviously they want to hold on to their Ether, but maybe they would also like to be able to kind of use their funds in the meantime. So perhaps they have expenses to pay, or they would actually like to make a big purchase, say like a house or a car. So if they can borrow funds against the Ether, that can benefit them. And that's what Liquity enables people to do. So they post their Ether as collateral, mm-hmm. and they then use our system to borrow our native stablecoin, LUSD. And this stablecoin is pegged one-to-one to the US dollar. And once they have that LUSD stablecoin, they can then do anything they like with it. They could trade it for fiat money and then buy something in the physical world, or mm-hmm. they could actually maybe use it to earn interest in the crypto ecosystem. And they could also actually use it to increase their Ether exposure if they wanted to kind of go through a leverage cycle. So yeah, there's a few different ways they can use the funds.
So the main goal is to allow people to basically monetize their Ether while keeping it. Is that a correct way of saying it, or am I making it too simple now?
Yeah, that's the primary use case. It's really to get liquidity or unlock liquidity against your holdings. And it's for people who have that bullish view on the Ether, so they expect it to appreciate. And yeah. The loan is actually interest-free as well, so it's kind of unique in that sense.
Yeah, so it's interest-free to put your Ether in your vault, basically, and then get those stable coins. So I've actually compared basically stable coins in one of my earlier videos about central banking to what they used to do in the 17th century in the Netherlands, for example, the Bank of Amsterdam, or you could go with actual gold, you know, deposit gold in the Bank of Amsterdam, then get some Bank of Amsterdam deposits and trade with those deposits. I think it's very similar to that. What do you think of that comparison?
Yeah, I think there's definitely similarities. Like the basic mechanism is pretty similar. There are definitely differences with kind of blockchain technology mm-hmm. in that it's fully decentralized. So, well, our system is at least, so that you can actually, you know, you interact directly with the protocol on Ethereum. So this kind of system of rules kind of encoded in smart contract code that lives on the blockchain, it's kind of an automatic machine in a way. And so there's no kind of middleman or banker deciding if you should or shouldn't be allowed to make this deposit and take this loan. It's all fully automated. It's fully permissionless. So actually anybody can make that Ether deposit and draw LUSD against it, as long as they're kind of meeting the conditions baked into the protocol.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I think that's a really good, because the thing is, like, I'm an economist, and so I love to compare this to the stuff that I already know. So that would be a bank. But you're definitely right to point out that it really isn't, because there is no middleman, right? Can you tell a little bit more about, you know, how that then works? Because I think, you know, I know there are also a lot of blockchain enthusiasts in the chat who definitely will think this is a piece of cake, but I think for the economics crowd, it's a bit mind-blowing.
Sure, yeah. So blockchain is basically a kind of, it's a tamper-proof record of actions and transactions. And it's tamper-proof because it lives on thousands of computers around the world, and they all hold the same record of history, of the kind of like transaction history. And basically it's kind of secured by the miners. You've probably heard about these miners who mine cryptocurrency, that they actually are kind of paid to secure the network and like make it tamper-proof.
But these are the Ethereum miners then, right?
Yeah, so that's kind of the underlying blockchain technology. And then on Ethereum, it's possible to build applications that borrow its kind of trust properties. So, you know, we've deployed Liquity to Ethereum, and the application itself is actually set in stone, because like we've deployed the code And that code is the same across all those machines that run the Ethereum network. And we've actually removed ourselves as owners of that code. So now there's actually no kind of admin or central controller of the Liquity system. And so the code is immutable. It can't be changed ever. It could only kind of be changed if the Ethereum network itself is changed. So it has this kind of powerful property of borrowing the trust of the underlying network. And yeah, in doing so, that makes it... it means you can trust the code instead of, you know, trusting the operator, basically.
So that immediately makes me want to ask two questions. One is, so if you are not there, then I would immediately wonder, like, okay, how then do you make money? And then the second would be, if it's fixed, the code is fixed, what happens if there is a bug or a feature of the system that doesn't work as you expected? But let's maybe do the first question first. Like, how do you then make money? Because somebody is paying you, right?
Right. So the Liquity business model is pretty unconventional. We do have a small one-time borrowing fee on every loan that's issued. So it's actually applied to the debt when somebody takes a loan. So if somebody borrows, say, 2,000 LUSD, the borrowing fee is typically a one-time upfront fee of about 0.5%. So they will then owe 2,000 plus 10. So they'll owe 2,010 LUSD. That's what they'll have to repay eventually. And those fees go to holders of the native system token, which is a secondary token called LQTY. And holders of this token can stake it in our system, and the fees just get immediately sent to those holders and split pro rata across all the holders. So it's a little bit like kind of analogous to shares and dividends. So like, you know, having a dividend of profits split between the shareholders.
Yeah. So indeed, when I was looking at sort of your protocol, I was thinking as well, okay, if I need to compare it to a bank, even though it's of course not a bank in the sense that there is no entity, you could still say that sort of the assets would be Ethereum that's locked away, right? And then you issue these coins against those and people holding that are fairly similar to deposit holders. And then you have equity holders, right? And they are the ones that are crucial, I would guess. Because sometimes, you know, people might make a loss on their loans, right? And they are the buffer there, just like in a normal bank. But can you maybe elaborate a little bit more on how that work and how that works? And also, for example, the staking, because I think staking is something that's a bit foreign for us who are not necessarily always in the crypto space, especially since, like, I know that staking is putting your, I think staking is putting your crypto to work on the blockchain to verify the transactions through a proof of stake mechanism. But then again, what does confuse me is a little bit like, aren't there also the miners? Did Ethereum move from proof of work to proof of stake? Or is this something that's your protocol? Like, how does that work?
Yes, I'll tackle the staking piece then. So basically, there's kind of two layers of staking. There's the kind of underlying blockchain network, which is the Ethereum network. And yes, they will be moving to a full proof of stake system soon. And that's kind of like a way of securing the network. And it's to do with network security and how the transactions are ordered. So that's very separate from what we call staking in Liquity. Mm. And staking Liquity is much simpler. It's really just a case of there's this kind of pool where you can put your LQTY tokens, which are similar to the equity in the system. And when you put them in the pool, all revenues that pass through the system just kind of get split between those as members of the pool. It's really just a way to, it's actually a technical implementation for distributing the revenues to the LQTY holders, because it would be very expensive to like send it out individually to all the holders, and you'd probably need some manual process. Whereas if they can actually just put it all in the pool, you can just easily send it to that pool and have it split up automatically. So it's really kind of just a technical way to issue dividends, if you like.
So the staking there doesn't verify any transactions?
That's correct, yeah. It's nothing to do with like proof of stake or anything like that.
Ah, okay. It is super confusing to me that you give it the same name then, or is that just me being non-initiated?
I agree. I think... it is confusing. It's just kind of like how the terminology is played out in the space. There's staking at the protocol layer and there's staking at the app layer, and they're very different. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then also you said, hey, we make money through, there's a small percentage every time someone gets into a new loan agreement on the in the protocol. But you also said there's no interest, but isn't there then an interest rate? Like a small, a hidden one?
You know, there's always a way to sort of make the, you know, you could calculate the effective interest rate, right? But the I suppose the main point with Liquity is it's a one-time upfront fee, and you know exactly what you pay upfront, and the term of the loan is unlimited. So, you know, your effective interest rate will change depending on just how long you want to keep the loan open for. So it's better value to keep it open for longer because you've already kind of incurred the fee at the point you open the loan.
Okay. So, and then there's also, how do you keep the value? Like, because this is very different, I think, from my Bank of Amsterdam example. Because there, sort of, you have the gold in the vault, and then the Bank of Amsterdam money, you know, sort of creates liquidity for people who have gold. They can spend that money. But you do something similar with Ether. However, your tokens are pegged to US dollars. And this was different in this Bank of Amsterdam. It's just like pegged to gold. You're not pegged to Ether. Like, why is that, and how does that work?
Yeah, so the equity holders, the value of the equity, we'll call it the LQTY token because that's what it is. So it's like, it's not really, the value of that is not guaranteed. That can go up and down. Mm-hmm. And people can, you know, the market values that based on like expected revenues in the system. So last year we did like $28 million in revenue, and then people can kind of extrapolate that back to the value of one LQTY token because there's a finite supply of those. But the other side of things is this LUSD token, and that is pegged to the dollar. And that's, we want that to maintain a very good price stability. And yeah, I mean, it's like the Ether is the collateral, which is mm-hmm. a volatile asset, but you borrow dollars against that. But we do ensure that the whole system is always over-collateralized so that the value of the total collateral in the system is greater than the value of the outstanding LUSD debt. And that's enforced kind of at the individual level, where each borrower has to maintain a minimum collateral ratio of 110%. So if they deposit like $11,000 worth of ETH, they can't borrow more than 10,000 LUSD. And if they fall below that level, they're actually vulnerable to liquidation. And it's those liquidations that keep the system healthy and keep it over-collateralized and keep the LUSD fully backed.
Yeah, because that's how I interpret that your stablecoin differs from a lot of others, right? Like how I see it, yours, and maybe this will piss off some sort of crypto, you know, people who have a crypto ideology of getting off the fiat-based system. You build on the fiat system because that's what you ultimately peg to, I would say. But then there are a lot of stablecoins that build on the fiat system directly because they sort of have like 100% reserve bank situation going on where they have a lot of fiat assets like US treasuries, and then they issue stable coins against that. But you have sort of Ethereum in between, and how I understand, like, because Ethereum fluctuates, you need people to put in more Ethereum, and hence that's over collateralized to make sure, you know, that the peg isn't broken. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's because we have this volatile asset, Ether, that can drop, you know, 10 or 20% in a day. We need it to be, you know, sufficiently over-collateralized to actually fully back the LUSD supply, yeah.
Yeah, but what happens if, because I think you're over-collateralized 110%, is that right?
That's the minimum on an individual level, yes.
Oh yeah, okay. And people can choose how much they want to be over-collateralized.
Yeah, right. And we have kind of the riskier borrowers and the safer borrowers. And we have many people at like 200 or 300% collateral ratio. So they have like collateral to their debt. And then we have, you know, the riskier ones who like to ride the boundary and stay closer to that 110%. Yeah.
Because then you sort of monetize more of your Ether and you're still invested in Ether and you can spend it on other stuff as well.
Yeah.
Right. But then, how do I lose if I do that? Like if I borrow from you, through your system, through your protocol, I borrow from someone else through your protocol and I over collateralize at 110% because I love risk. But the price of Ether now drops by more than 10%, which actually happened, I think, right? Not too long ago, or probably for some borrowers. How does that then work?
So I'll talk about just kind of a small price drop first, and then maybe like we can talk about the kind of more extreme scenarios. Mm-hmm. So like In Liquity, when somebody falls below that 110%, they're immediately vulnerable to liquidation. And liquidations are very quick in Liquity. So they happen within seconds or minutes of a trove falling below that level, because the actual process is kind of automatic within the system and pretty much instant. And so the only kind of time delay is based upon like waiting for somebody to actually trigger the liquidation. And it's a publicly accessible function. So anybody can kind of press the liquidation button and liquidate a position in Liquity. And in doing so, they actually get compensated for that, because there are transaction costs on Ethereum. Anytime you take any action, it costs a bit of Ether. So our system actually pays out some LUSD and some Ether to more than cover the cost of liquidation. So it's kind of like well incentivized, and these liquidations do happen pretty much instantly when somebody is vulnerable to it. So most liquidations we see happening, you know, even if the price of Ether is dropping heavily or quite fast, we see liquidations happen at like 109% or 108%, you know, just as the position's just fallen below the minimum collateral ratio.
Mm-hmm. That happens automatically then, sort of.
Yeah, you can think of it as automatic. It's kind of outsourced to anybody who wants to actually trigger that function.
To the lender, basically, or the borrower. Who triggers that function? I didn't quite catch
it. It can actually be anybody, like anybody with a, you know, can sit at their laptop and just call that function. They can go on a website that accesses Liquity, see a vulnerable trove, liquidate it, and make a profit. So it's kind of a race between, you know,
Okay, interesting. So if you and I are through your protocol in a loan agreement, you know, someone who's watching live now can actually liquidate that agreement between the two of us.
So there wouldn't be an agreement between two parties in Liquity. It's really just you borrow against your own collateral, and the borrowed funds are just minted by the system when you borrow. Yeah. So, but in terms of liquidation, that's right. Like, anyone, a third party, you know, not Liquity, not you, the borrower, just someone else on the internet can liquidate you. And actually, originally, like when we launched, we saw that happening, these kind of manual liquidations where people actually pressing that button on the front end website. But now it's kind of become much more automated, and people run bots and do it more professionally. And it's kind of like, you know, it's within seconds, liquidations happen from these professional liquidators.
And they get a share of what exactly if they do that? Like, how do they get rewarded for that?
So when somebody takes out a loan, 200 LUSD is reserved as a kind of compensation for in case of liquidation. Mm-hmm. So that's paid out to the liquidator. Mm. But also, we actually take a small cut of the collateral that is in the loan. We call the loans troves, actually. So in the trove, there's the Ether collateral, and we take a small cut, which is 0.5%, and that's sent to the liquidator. So that kind of compensates liquidators, even in extreme times of very high network congestion, when the transaction costs are very high. It can always be profitable to liquidate a trove if it's big enough.
Yeah. So shall I have a look at the chat and see? Because I think this is something, you know, we just have to get through this a little bit. I don't think it's on the one hand, it's a very difficult system. On the other hand, it's not, in the sense that it's very logical, but it's pretty tough not to crack if you haven't been working in it, I think. So shall I just have a look at the chat and see what people say and ask those questions to you then? Okay, let's have a see. So John says, I don't understand the decentralization part. The more I learn of it, so it becomes more of a first come, first serve. I guess referring to the liquidator, John. And Alan asks, how does the liquidation happen? Because my borrowed funds were used to buy Ether. Are these the right questions to ask? Can you make sense of them?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of decentralization, if he's referring to the liquidation, then it's true it is kind of first come, first serve. It is actually a race. But it's decentralized in that it's, you know, anybody can do it. So it's kind of permissionless, right? It's like an open, we're not saying only we can liquidate or only some special party can liquidate. It's actually anybody in the world could liquidate.
Hey, and
that does make it a race. True. Yeah.
There is actually another question as well. So Felipe, I think this is a crucial question, because this is very much the sort of where our economists thinking about banks' brain struggles with something like Liquity. Okay. So Felipe asked, how do you determine the borrower's credit worthiness?
Yeah, great question. So because Liquity is like open and permissionless, actually, yeah, that we have to find another way to do it rather than looking at reputation. So it's really all automated. So by kind of requiring that the borrower has this minimum collateral ratio, we know that they're always going to be over collateralized. And as soon as they drop below that, they get liquidated. And so it's like kind of like everybody has to play by the same rules in liquidity. So there's kind of no way to default, because you know, if you don't pay back your loan, it's okay. The collateral kind of more than covers your debt. So and if it ever drops in value such that it's below this minimum threshold, then you'll be liquidated. So everybody's subject to the same rules, and there's no kind of need to assess creditworthiness actually.
Yeah, so that is, that's also something that I struggled with, you know, when I started reading about these types of stable coins. But, you know, it makes sense, I think. Like, for example, if you would do this with a house, you post a house worth $200,000 to the system, for example, you get $200,000 and you get $180,000. And the moment that the house price drops anywhere close to 180, you get liquidated before that. So there's never a loss on anyone other than yourself because of the collateral, right?
Right.
So and that's also why you don't have to, there's not the traditional banking that you have to care about the creditworthiness of any borrower. You only care about the collateral.
Yeah, and Ether is very simple collateral. It's like, you know, it's fungible. It's one single cryptocurrency.
Okay, so Elon actually said that I looked at the wrong question. So the right one, can I borrow against my Ether to buy more Ether? And then if Ether drops too much, I get instantly liquidated, which would cause Ether to drop more, which would cause someone else to get liquidated.
That's a really good question, yeah. So you can definitely leverage up like that. You can kind of deposit Ether, borrow LUSD, sell it for Ether, redeposit, and kind of increase your ETH exposure. So you can actually leverage up. You can do that up to like 11x leverage in our system by kind of going through that leverage cycle a few times. It doesn't affect the price of Ether because our system actually gets the external price of Ether from the market. So we use an external data provider that like feeds in the Ether price to our system. We don't like sort of have some internal measure of Ether price like they would on, say, a centralized exchange where they're actually, you know, the trading is occurring on such an exchange and they have their own kind of Ether price.
But if you're very big, doesn't it affect the price of Ether?
Yeah. If we got big enough such that like the majority of Ether was in our system, yes, then there'd be this kind of like extra effect. We're not quite that big yet. So it's like, I think less than 1% of all Ether is in liquidity. But, you know, that'd be like a very kind of...
Yeah, but...
You know, but it's one of the reasons why we chose Ether actually, because it is such a big, has a big liquidity pool and it's good for collateral.
But aren't there a lot of protocols like you, like stablecoins that do something similar like this, so that maybe in all stablecoins there is a lot of Ether locked up like this, or is that not the case?
Yeah, there are. It's a good question, like what the aggregate impact would be of all these kind of lending protocols. I mean, Ether is not only used in lending protocols, it's on exchanges, it's in different places. I think like the ecosystem as a whole kind of balance, because there's borrowing, lending, saving, trading. Ether's used like for NFTs and payments and things like that. So it's quite diverse. But yeah, I think that there is a risk, like if it all got too concentrated in one kind of product, that could happen. Yeah.
So the way I looked at it first is because when I started looking into this, I was definitely thinking about the same type of questions that were just asked in the chat, in the sense that I was thinking from a financial stability kind of perspective. And what we have seen in financial markets in 2007, 2008, which, you know, completely collapsed, is actually something rather similar to what you're doing, in the sense that there came into force, or into, you know, something new was invented, which was market-based banking. And what market-based banking, a big part of that are repo markets. And I think this is fairly similar in a way to what's happening in repo markets, in the sense that you can borrow very liquid money by posting, you know, excess collateral, an illiquid asset. And what you did see in repo markets, and what you also, for example, saw in repo markets during COVID in 2019, I think, or 2020, 2020, I guess, that you saw this very big and sudden collapse in U.S. treasuries, which was very strange, because, you know, I even owned U.S. treasuries at the time, because this is usually a very safe asset. This is the safest asset you can have on a from a global currency perspective. And then a lot of economists sort of came up with, why is this happening? Well, because repo markets have gotten so big that a small drop in US treasuries caused sort of all of that collateral to no longer be sufficient. And hence, people had to close their positions. And to do that, they had to sell more treasuries. And so that would suppress the treasury price even further. And that would cause even more collateral that needed to be sold. Like, you can see how that might form a positive feedback loop. And I wonder if this also might be the case, you know, if a lot of protocols are there like you, right? If you get, or if you get big enough.
Yeah, if a big enough chunk of the total ether supply is kind of used as collateral in lending protocols, then yeah, I think that risk probably does increase. Just in terms of like our individual system, I would say we're quite protected against the need to kind of actually sell off the collateral, because we have this part of the system called a stability pool. And that's almost like an insurance pool where people can deposit their LUSD. And when liquidations occur, it's that pool that will buy the collateral and clear the debt. So it's kind of like the funds are already there and ready to buy the collateral. And the reason why people like to deposit there is primarily because, well, partly we kind of issue LQTY tokens as a kind of incentive to deposit there. But we also, it's basically like when a liquidation occurs at like below 110%, but above 100%, it's actually profitable for whoever receives that collateral, because they clear the debt, but they make more in collateral than they get by clearing the debt. So members of the stability pool can actually make a profit by buying those liquidations. And it happens instantly and automatically when liquidations occur.
So this is separate from the LQTY tokens that you mentioned, right?
Yes, it's a separate piece, yeah.
Can I compare this to anything in banking? Because we try to compare the LQTY to equity. Like, how would I see... Do you think there is an analogy in normal finance?
I think the closest is probably like an insurance pool or something, where people kind of provide funds in advance, and it's a bit different. It's kind of a mixture of insurance plus, like, you know, buying the collateral in advance. I think it's hard to think of something that's identical actually in traditional finance, because in the stability pool they would expect a profit most of the time if the liquidated loan has like a collateral surplus, so it's like still above 100% collateral ratio. But if the ETH price has, you know, dropped a lot and pulled that loan down below 100%, then it would actually realize a loss for those stability pool depositors who kind of automatically buy that collateral.
Okay, I think now I have found a question of a user that's more into this ecosystem than I am. Fadi asks, what's going to make Liquity attract more users against Compound / AAVE? I hope I pronounced it correctly. AAVE.
Yes.
These are other stablecoins, I guess?
So these are kind of multi-sided lending markets with like a borrower and a lender. So somebody could choose to be a lender on Compound or Aave, and they could take the other side and be a borrower. So it's a different proposition, because we don't have lenders. It's really you're borrowing against you're kind of like the system is issuing the LUSD in Liquity. So one advantage we have is this low collateral ratio, low minimum. So the 110% collateral ratio is kind of unprecedented in DeFi. And there's no interest rate. So you just pay this one-time upfront fee, and you can compare the fee to interest rates in other protocols. And if your loan is long enough, that one-time upfront fee will always be an interest rate. Yeah, so...
So your interest rates are lower, and that's how you attract users away from borrowers, at least, away from those protocols. Is that yeah. Summary?
It's definitely like one thing people like, I think. Also, I think like we've really focused on being kind of very purist with the decentralization. So we've like made the system completely immutable and unchangeable. I think other protocols often have upgradability or some kind of governance or admin control. And some users see that as a downside. Some users see it as a plus, because it can be upgraded and improved. But for Liquity, we took the other approach, where it's just like set in stone from the start. And that seems to appeal to many people.
Hey, but what I don't understand about that is, you know, we tried to schedule a stream before. And at some point, you were very busy. And also at some points, I was very busy. But anyway, it seemed to me that you were working on an upgrade or something. But how is it possible if the system is immutable?
Right, so the core system is immutable. That's true. It's always possible to build kind of extra layers that plug into it or integrations around it. So we've done a lot of research in terms of like new systems and also kind of like complementary systems. But yeah, that core system of Liquity is out there set in stone and can't be changed at all. But it is possible to build integrations or plugins that kind of attach onto it. Yeah.
So can you name an example of a plugin? What should I think about?
Right. So one example is like a protocol called B Protocol. They utilize our stability pool. And so in the stability pool, a depositor deposits LUSD. And over time, their LUSD deposit depletes, but it gets kind of replaced with ETH and LQTY. That happens when liquidations occur. So they kind of, they buy these liquidations. And what B Protocol do is they automatically convert those kind of liquidation gains back into LUSD. So it's kind of an auto-compounding protocol. So you can deposit in LUSD and, you know, if you withdraw after some liquidations, you'll get pure LUSD back. So it's kind of a nice nice addition.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So that makes it easier for the users, but it doesn't fundamentally alter the structure of your protocol.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Hey, one thing that I do wonder about this, and now we're also wondering in sort of a pet project of mine. So what I did during my PhD is something called agent-based modeling. Now, I've seen that you've also worked on something like that, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. But what I learned there is, so what I then did is I built these simulation models of sort of interacting agents, and they have a behavior. And, you know, I thought about this, like what would be realistic behavior? But what I noticed is that very often, when I made such a system, so think about like I made an entire macro economy. So there were like households and firms and banks and a central bank and a government, and they all interacted with each other via set rules. I think that's a bit similar to how you have thought about before, probably when designing this protocol, like how people will act. You thought about their behavior and that's how you structured the incentives, I think. You will correct me later on this if I'm wrong. But what I noticed there is that because if a system is complex, meaning that if one party interacts with the other party, and then that party interacts, like even if the behavior is relatively simple, you can get very surprising outcomes. And so what I noticed there is, or what my instinct sort of, how my instinct around that developed is like immutability is horrible because very often something happened in those simulations and it might have happened only in let's say 3 out of 500 randomly generated simulations that I never expected beforehand. And so, you know, that's what we would call a bug, right? And then I had to update the system to accommodate that. But if you don't have that feature, like, you know, like how do you view that?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, I think like the more interactions you have between agents, generally, the more unintended consequences you're going to see for sure. I suppose with Liquity, there's not really that kind of high level of interactivity between the agents. You know, it's like people are interacting directly with the protocol. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a borrower is borrowing directly from the protocol using their own collateral. And they're not interacting with other borrowers per se. They can obviously sell their LUSD, but that's quite a simple interaction. It's like you're buying or selling it.
Yeah, but I guess people who put money in the liquidity pool, who stake LQTY or who borrow, they do interact in some way, right?
Yeah, you can. I mean, they're taking a share of the pool for sure and a share of whatever kind of rewards go to that pool. But, you know, they're part of an aggregate. But again, they're kind of not, they're not interacting directly with other pool members, I would say. But like, it's a great point about immutability. I think like it is it's a trade-off and it's a design decision. You know, you lose something and you gain something from it. And yeah, we were pretty paranoid about like just testing as many worst case scenarios as possible and doing as much modeling as we could do kind of for ourselves and hiring external agencies to do that and spending a ton of time on security and kind of crypto economic analysis and really trying to get everything right. So yeah, it is a trade-off, you know. But you can also make the case for upgradability. Like upgradability itself with blockchain protocols actually introduces bugs and introduces more surface area for things to go wrong. And we've seen things go wrong when protocols have done an upgrade or a kind of new governance proposal and things have broken like 2 days after the change. So yeah, that's also a risk as well.
Yeah, okay. So you're making sort of the argument like keep it simple a little bit. And then you also have less of this, the chance that you, something happens that's unexpected. Like, as I mentioned, I do agree with that. If I look back at my modeling adventures, the simpler models almost never really, didn't have that problem as much, for sure. That's definitely true. And you also use agent-based modeling, right, when designing this protocol? So basically maybe to simulate sort of some scenarios. Is that how you used it?
Yeah, so we did some basic modeling ourselves, but we also hired an external firm who were kind of experts in the area to really dig into it. And they kind of, the goal for that was to stress test the system. We hired this company called Gauntlet, who do a lot of modeling for blockchain firms. And basically we wanted to see, like, you know, how does the system stand up under very high ETH volatility and under very high network transaction costs. And so they created a bunch of different agents with these kind of like range of preferences for kind of risk tolerance and also, like, I think response time. So like some agents would react quickly to the ETH price and some would never touch their position and kind of forget about it. Mm-hmm. And they did this big modeling kind of run with like these parameter sweeps over all these different configurations and found that, well, they were kind of looking to see at what minimum collateral ratio do things start to go a bit wrong and what minimum collateral ratio would be safe. And they found that the parameters we chose in the end, this 110% minimum collateral ratio, is very safe with a low risk of insolvency, very low risk. Mm-hmm. And they also found that the system would only enter something called recovery mode very rarely. And this is a mode of the system where it tries to kind of avoid becoming insolvent when it's getting a bit close to that level.
And how does the system get insolvent? I know it's an edge case, but does it happen when the price of Ethereum drops so fast such that the liquidations don't come in fast enough such that some loans have to be liquidated when Ether price is already below collateral value?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that's really kind of how we define insolvency with liquidity. It's if the total collateral ratio, so that all the backing of Ether against the total outstanding debt, if that ever falls below 100%, we could consider the system insolvent. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, that's obviously a situation the system does its best to avoid. And it, as you said, it comes down to that comparison between how fast the Ether price drops and how fast we can liquidate to clear out the unhealthy loans. So, you know, liquidations are very fast in liquidity. And one thing we did was we looked at kind of the biggest price drop that can happen between two updates of the data feed for the Ether price. And historically, it's never gone above 10%. It's mostly like much lower than that. And so we realized that actually that's the margin you need for the collateral surplus in the minimum. So if the maximum price drop between two updates is 10%, we need a minimum collateral ratio of 110%. And actually, since like we kind of did that analysis, the maximum price deviation has actually decreased because the data feed provider has got better with their kind of, yeah, the way they provide data, basically. So basically, yeah, liquidations have to happen very quickly and clear out the bad debt.
Yeah, but first of all, I think it's like, this is when I read about your protocol first. I love to see that actually agent-based modeling has some uses like that, because in economics, it never really got on, because it, like from a scientific perspective, it's not that interesting. If to build a very complex model to show something very simple, then sort of, you know, it ended up such that people preferred building a very simple model just to show some simple mechanism, basically, you know, that, right, then you can write a shorter paper. But I always had in the back of my mind, like, it would be cool to sort of stress test systems before they come online using an agent-based model, and then you can learn sort of, you know, where it might break. Like, it might break if humans enter as well, but at least you maybe have sort of sniffed out two or three scenarios beforehand. So that's how you used it, right?
Absolutely, yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah, and there's always factors you can't control and irrational behavior you won't capture, but it is really good for catching some things, yeah.
Hey, and if we go into a little bit of more of the philosophical, you know, part of this protocol and crypto in general, I've noticed, and I've also seen like people post that or allude to that in some of the comments that in a post that I made, you know, announcing us talking. And that is, isn't there a little bit of a intellectual friction between sort of the core, or maybe I shouldn't say core, but one big crypto ideology, which is fixed money supply? And, Ether has that, some form of that, I think, right? But what you do is sort of you allow that to multiply by a lot. So you're basically sort of creating money within crypto. How do you view that?
Yeah, that's a good point. So I think you could sort of see it in aggregate as, I think because we're locking Ether as collateral, and the fact that the LUSD created is always backed one-to-one by Ether. I mean, I suppose, you could consider that Ether almost as coming out of the money supply in a way, mm-hmm. if you're then issuing LUSD against it. So there is some balance there. Mm-hmm. We're not just kind of printing money with no backing. So that would be an inflationary system. But actually Ether itself is somewhat inflationary. It's not fully, fully hard cap supply.
Yeah. But you are creating more purchasing power within the crypto space, right? Because people can actually use those, they hold the Ether and then they can use the new money that I will say that you have printed to buy other cryptos, driving up their price.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Which is inflationary if we use sort of the price inflationary sort of way of talking about inflation.
Yeah, I take that point.
Do you get discussions around this topic a lot, or is it something that basically lives besides each other? Because I've mainly talked to, I've talked to one stablecoin project before, and also it was interesting because it was more of sort of a recognition, but there's not really sort of this friction. It sounds like there are two types of crypto people. Maybe the people who are super hard about the fixed money supply are just more vocal.
Yeah, I think... particularly the Bitcoin community, this is a really big kind of passion of theirs, or kind of core value. Bitcoin has this hard cap supply and Ether is slightly inflationary. And I think one criticism the Bitcoin people have of Ether is that it's kind of more subject to a social consensus among the kind of people who develop and promote Ethereum. It's they may change the inflation rate in future, right? Whereas Bitcoin supposedly wouldn't, and it's supposed to be more of a guarantee there. But I think everything is a social consensus in some way. Even the kind of Bitcoin system, it's still a social consensus that everybody runs the same software that has this hard cap supply. And if enough people decide to change or think it should be inflationary, it would then change. So it's just that there are more people who do prefer a hard cap supply in Bitcoin. So it probably is less likely to change. I think everything is social consensus.
Shall we see if the chat has anything to say about this? Because there might be some controversy surrounding this, I would imagine. Let me have a look. I also know that in my audience, there are also a lot of people who are not necessarily on board with this part of crypto and who sort of see a flexible money supply as being a good thing. Fadi says, outstanding market supply of stablecoins would rank them in the top 20 financial institutions in the US. I guess he's probably then referring to all stablecoins.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Yeah. Is that true? How big are you on the financial systems or sort of player scale?
I think that's true if you include the kind of bank coins that are backed by deposits in a bank, like Tether, which is very big. And that dwarfs even the biggest kind of crypto collateralized backed stablecoin. So yeah, it depends how you define stablecoin. In terms of crypto collateral stablecoins, it's the top ones. It's not more than a few billion, I think, of money supply, US dollars.
And how, because you have been, so look, if I look at stablecoins, the worry that I always had is this is creating a lot of extra liquidity in the crypto system. And it's mainly being used to buy other crypto coins. That's how I see it. And please correct me if you think, no, this is actually feeding into the real economy, as I would say it. And so how I view that is sort of, even though I think it's a bit different, especially what you're doing from leverage in the traditional sense, because people don't borrow, like you mentioned, from someone else necessarily. They just borrow against their own collateral. I do think a lot of liquidity can, or it comes across as if there's a big bear market. So the price of crypto, something like Ether, is going down a lot of the liquidity will evaporate. So your system basically will shrink. There has been a bit of a bear market. Is that what happened? So did LAUSD sort of shrink by quite a bit?
Yeah, that's true. And it is. Yeah. And we see that on kind of days where Ether crashes a lot. Yeah, it shrinks. There's liquidations occur and people repay their loans to stay to avoid liquidation. So that is how it works. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's very interesting because that was a rather eye-opening for me because I used to compare it to sort of this market-based banking where then the banks can go bust and that will really sort of kick in sort of a downward cycle because then you know, your credit providers are bust. That's not the case with your system, right? Like the system cannot really go bust. And so, but it does, I think, have sort of an amplifying effect because it, you know, if liquidity disappears in a system that's under stress, then the system will be more under stress. But if that system for one reason or another stabilizes, then your liquidity can also come back relatively quickly, right?
Yeah, it can. Yeah. I think the idea with liquidity is really to try and, it should be kind of dynamic. It should respond to the market. It should contract and expand as needed. I guess you can get some kind of cascade effects when all these crypto systems, as you said, like if crypto is used just in other systems, if you just issue LUSD just to use it in another system, or, you know, the more interconnected they are, the more you can get some kind of cascade effects. I think that's true. And it would be nice to see more real world usage. And that is something we're kind of like, we hope to see, like people actually taking loans for, you know, real world purposes, like, you know, buying a house or a car, or maybe like paying for their studies or something like that. But I think, yeah, crypto is quite, it is a bit insular, the whole ecosystem. I think that's fair.
But it's true, right? That people take a loan to buy other cryptocurrencies or do you know use cases where they don't do that?
They can do. That's one use case. They might, for example, if they take an LUSD loan, they could use that LUSD. They could actually become an LP, so a liquidity provider on an exchange. So they could deposit it to an exchange and it would actually, they would just like capture some trading fees on an exchange. So they're not actually using it to buy crypto. They're using it to just like buy liquidity and then earn fees on that. And there's other places they can kind of earn interest on it as well.
Right.
Yeah.
But it still stays then within the crypto ecosystem and it still serves maybe as a function to increase other cryptocurrency prices.
Potentially, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is just something, yeah, it's a bit, that's a bit where I struggle with stable coins in the sense that, so I think what you're doing from a technical perspective is amazing because it's very innovative, like to have a decentralized bank, so to say, or bank-ish kind of thing is very interesting. I think I would really love to see something like this be implemented to support the real economy rather than more speculation in crypto or speculation in the financial sector in general. I don't have anything against crypto that I don't have against finance in general, in the sense that I just think that there are too many sort of asset booms and busts and bubbles and too many people sort of earning their money with trading stuff rather than creating stuff, so to say. And I would really, do you think it's possible to sort of apply the lessons that we learned here to I don't know, you know, this is that the other project, that this was the reserve project, they were thinking about that at least. It's like, hey, how can we bring money to societies where there isn't money? So maybe something like the lessons that you have learned here can be used for a money system that can sort of emerge in a country where there is not enough of a money system. And you can maybe post collateral, not ether, but a house, right? Or something that people actually have there. But that's probably very difficult because ether is super easy to post as collateral in a blockchain system, right?
Yeah, that's it's hard to get like real world assets sort of into the blockchain system. It's kind of a closed system in a way because it's hard for it to know about external things that aren't like part of the Ethereum network. Yeah, it would be nice. And I think like that originally that was the vision, is to kind of enable, you know, the man on the street to borrow against their assets and actually use that for something important in their life, right? Covering expenses or, you know, buying an important purchase. And people can borrow LUSD and then sell it for fiat and do that. But yeah, I do agree that there is a big financial focus at the moment in crypto.
And also on the street typically doesn't have ether.
It's true. It's true, but for now, yeah. But it has, you know, it's improving. Many more people are becoming aware of it and using these products. And it's also like in terms of the kind of financial sector aspect of it and the the comparison to traditional finance, I would say the one big difference that crypto has is that it's actually all transparent. So you can't quite have a crash like the GFC, because the GFC, all these kind of like bad assets were opaque, right? Like people didn't see until it was too late that it was like a bunch of bad mortgages wrapped up and sold as high quality securities.
But I wonder if that's true, because I think those bad mortgages only became bad mortgages when the price of houses dropped. Like before that, they were fine mortgages.
Okay, yeah. I mean, had you actually kind of like, I guess it's like The Big Short, right? Had you gone to those areas and sort of like taken the pulse of the area, you would have sort of said, well, this isn't really a AAA security. This is like a risky thing that's been resold and resold and kind of rebranded.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Yeah. So, but your asset, like if we compare it to The Big Short where they have the houses, right? Your asset is the asset backing all of this is, you know, the big crypto coins like Ether and Bitcoin. And they're sort of the barometer that I typically use to see if we're in a bubble or not is how many bots are spamming my comments for people to buy crypto, and how many of my neighbors who know nothing about finance are talking about crypto.
Yeah.
But I still think you could have that, though. Does that make sense? What I'm trying to say is like, because the foundation that you're building on is really based on pure trust. Like I know that people say money is based on trust, but there I usually say, okay, but what trust in what, right? Trust of what type? And fiat money the government issued, I think is based on the trust that you can buy something useful from the government with that. That's why fiat currencies typically collapse when the government collapses, right? In Zimbabwe, you know, you cannot get much useful stuff from the government anyway. But here, for example, in Belgium, you know, I can pay my taxes in euros. That's something that backs that. Whereas like sort of the money that you're building on, I would say is more of a pure trust currency, because it's only about if people think that it will hold its value or increase in value in the future. What I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, definitely. I think it has to, one way or another, the cryptocurrencies, the kind of native ones, like the core ones like Ether, they have to bootstrap trust. You know, it doesn't come from, it's not there at the start, right? And it has to be built over time. But I do think the longer it survives, it's kind of a Lindy thing, right? This concept of like the longer something survives, more likely it will survive. I think there's something to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, yeah. You can see that already a little bit with something like Bitcoin, perhaps, right? It just has so much name recognition that even if it falls for a long time, it hasn't yet completely crashed, whereas some altcoins have maybe gone to zero.
Yes, definitely. And every time it sort of crashes and bounces back or even ends up higher than it's crashed, you know, that actually builds confidence, because people can look back and say, you know, well, it's, how many times has it crashed and come out stronger or survived at least? So I think like the transparency on the blockchain is important as well, because you can actually see every transaction. It's all public. And you can, like with Liquity, you can immediately see when something is under-collateralized and deal with that bad debt. I think that's one really cool aspect of the blockchain, is that just everything is visible to everybody and unhealthy positions are kind of exposed early on.
But is it also, like for Liquity, yes, I would agree, because that's so purely based on Ether as collateral, for which a price is known, right? But I wonder if it's, like one thing that I've always wondered is, yeah, the blockchain is open and for everybody to see, but you don't necessarily know sort of who holds that and what they have done to get that money. But this is maybe something that more applies to something like Bitcoin, for example, right? You still don't know if someone got their Bitcoin, you know, through selling drugs or, you know, by trading successfully in crypto markets in general.
Yeah, it's true. It's kind of pseudonymous. Like if you look at any given address, there's no kind of ID attached to an address, right? So yeah, but I think like the, in terms of tracking the bad stuff, like, you know, as you said, like drugs or, you know, kind of terrorism, financing of those activities, like it's quite viable to actually track all the transactions online and deduce what came from where. And there are firms that do that, like Chainalysis, for example, work with governments, and they're very good at tracking kind of the flows of funds and tracing it back to certain places. And I think that actually makes it not a good tool for these illicit uses, because it is so traceable. And you have to actually do the work to trace it, but it's all visible and transparent.
Hey, Rick, if I can maybe sort of try to bring our conversation together and then see if there are some more questions in the chat. I hope that, you know, through watching this conversation, people got a better idea of what a protocol like Liquity is about, and that it is truly decentralized money in the sense that it is really, there's not an intermediate entity. It's a protocol, and that the main use case has been for people to lock up their ether and basically monetize that or borrow, you know, in other words to say that, that's how I like to say it, but in other words to say that is like borrow LUSD with ether as collateral, and then this creates purchasing power. And in my opinion, that's money creation, because that can then be, people can then hold ether and buy something else as well. So the problem that I had with it, and I sensed some agreement from your side, is that it's still, as of now, largely within the crypto space. Whereas like how I posed my title of this video, and also what I saw in a lot of comments beforehand, is like, there's still sort of this drive to bring decentralized money into the real economy, so to say. And we're just not there yet, but maybe people can learn a lot from how you have organized your protocol. Would that be a fair summary?
Yeah, I think it's a fair summary. And if anybody does want to take a loan and use it in the real world, then they can borrow LUSD and trade it immediately on an exchange like Gemini for dollars, and then, you know, buy their actual real purchase. So it is doable, but it'd be great to see more of it.
Yeah, okay. That's a good optimistic note to end with. It is possible, right? Like I might have Ether. I want to invest in Ether. But I also want to start my own YouTube company for which I need funding. I can lock that up, that Ether, borrow LUSD, sell it for fiat, and buy some better microphone.
Exactly.
And be more productive. So it is possible to link it with the real economy, although we're a little bit in doubt about how much that actually happens. We might need to incentivize people, you know, more people to link up with the real economy.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, Rick, thank you so much. Let's see what people have to say in the chat. But there's also, like, this is interesting maybe for you as well, Rick. There's a vivid sort of discussion in the chat that is around the subjects that we discuss, but it's also a little bit contained in the sense that people are just arguing amongst each other. For example, Charlie Silva says we should not pretend that a financial crisis cannot happen with this. I don't think you pretended that, but Fadi says Bitcoin is a brand that has value. Bitcoin doesn't support programs, can't be coded on. That's why so many of you use Ether, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Oh, I have a question. I think, are there any stablecoins pegged to gold? Wouldn't this be safer? Alternative, considering the increase in gold price at the start of the Ukraine invasion, this could prevent insolvency, maybe. Could we build a stablecoin backed by gold, you think, Rick? Or will it then be a problem that gold is not on the blockchain?
That's the tricky part. If you have a volatile asset, then, how do you know when to liquidate? I think that's the tricky part. But, I mean, you could feed the gold price onto the blockchain. That's doable. It depends how you want to do it. I think there are some projects that have tried to do that. You could take the sort of Bankcoin approach where you have it actually deposited in a bank, or you could have, something where you... like a gold security or something where you then feed the price onto the blockchain, maybe. Kind of tricky because you've got to cross the, you've got to manage the collateral off-chain as well as deal with things on-chain.
Yeah. Hey, there's definitely a question here. And that, I think, relates to the discussion that we had at the end of our chat. Will a country ever be based on a decentralized currency?
Interesting. It would be really cool to see it. I honestly don't know if you'd see a country based on it. I think when you start to get into that level of like states and state currency, there's kind of geopolitical considerations as well that come into play, and it's not just financial. So I don't know. And there's big geopolitical players that kind of put pressure on smaller states when they start thinking about these things. But it would be super interesting to see for sure.
Yeah, what I find interesting there is that almost all of the stable coins link still to US dollar, right? So even though a lot of sort of people with political leanings towards, you know, not wanting to be attached to any government money, I think, you know, like your stablecoin is also linked to the US dollar still, right? Like Tether is a very famous example. But do you know any examples of stablecoins that are truly not coupled to the fiat system, don't really build on top of the fiat system?
Yeah, there is a project called Rai. I'm not sure. I think their intent was to create some kind of like something that is not coupled to any fiat, you know, fiat coin. But I think the trade-off there was the actual stability of the asset, because obviously it fluctuates in relation to any given coin or basket of fiat coins. But yeah, that's another interesting approach. They took a fully decentralized approach, or actually not fully, but quite decentralized approach, similar to us.
And how do you spell that? Rai? Like R-Y-E or?
R-A-I.
R-A-I. Okay, I'll post it in the chat for people who maybe want to look that up later. I also had a question earlier about, is this environmentally friendly? I would guess that depends on what Ethereum is doing, but I'm not sure if that's true.
Yeah, that's true. It basically depends on the kind of underlying energy efficiency of the blockchain. And Ethereum is currently using proof of work, which is not environmentally friendly. It's these warehouses of miners. But it's very quickly, very soon this year, going to move to proof of stake, which is much, much more environmentally friendly, where there's no mining involved, no kind of warehouses of computers churning numbers. It's just the consensus mechanism is formed by stakers. So yeah, it will improve a lot this year.
Okay, I also have a question here from earlier from my post is, what will be done to limit the ability of governments to interfere with your money?
So we've built this backend system on the blockchain, and we don't like operate the system. It's kind of this software that we've now deployed, and it lives on Ethereum. So I think it's really up to individual governments as to how they treat that. Like, we don't even actually operate a front end to our system. So we don't run a website that connects to the Liquity backend and allows people to interact with Liquity and borrow LUSD. Other people run those front ends, and they're based in different places, and it's up to them to comply with, you know, whatever regulations they're subject to based on where they live. So I think different governments have different opinions of these things. Seems like in the West, you know, like the UK, US seem to be hopefully going in a fairly kind of liberal direction with kind of favoring innovation, maybe, hopefully going that way. Maybe Europe is a bit more pro-regulation on that front. We'll see what happens. I think I expect some countries will kind of ban front ends to these decentralized finance systems, because they maybe see it as a destabilizing factor or something that they just don't want in the country. So yeah, like China, for example, I think it's very hard to access DeFi there now.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I've noticed is that in more and more, especially smaller emerging economies, crypto is having an influence in the sense that it's a way to get past capital controls. So even though you can't get your money out of the country easily via the normal banking system, which can be controlled more easily, you know, they do it via crypto. But then again, you can block access to crypto as well.
Yeah, you can always block these kind of on-ramps to and from the fiat system. So yeah, that's where governments would exert their control.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so I guess that comes back to what we discussed, right? There is a lot of interesting innovation going on in space, but it is still built on top of the fiat system. And I don't think anyone has come up with a way to get sort of detached from that. I'm not saying that you should want that necessarily, but that's, I think, a discussion for another video, probably. But maybe you have a stronger opinion on that than I do.
Sure. I would say it's like, the crypto ecosystem is definitely parallel, but it has these kind of ties into the fiat system. So for like pegging
strong
currency.
Ties, right?
Sorry, what's that?
Strong ties. Like your whole, your stablecoin is completely pegged to USD. That's a pretty strong tie, right? It's not a detail.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. And it's pegged to USD because USD is, you know, it's the kind of global reserve currency, right? So it's like the biggest, the largest liquidity. It's the one people want to denominate things in.
Yeah, no, true. Like government currencies also have that same issue, right? Like like big governments like Turkey or something like that, they also just have that reality that the US dollar is the global reserve. So you have to connect to that if you want to do international transactions.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But I do think you don't need a crypto system completely detached from the fiat world to have some benefits of it. So as I said, it's like fully transparent. It can be automatic. You can at least remove the kind of counterparty risk or the risk of a middleman messing with things. and things can be instant. You know, you can send crypto around the world in 30 seconds. You could send $1 billion of LUSD in 30 seconds for a fee of a few dollars, and the fee wouldn't change depending on the amount. So there are kind of just like straight advantages, whether or not it's, you know, kind of independent of how well it's coupled to fiat.
Right. Okay. So that is the case, because I actually ran into that issue, right? Like, I used to work in South Africa, where they have rands. I wanted to transfer money because I had to leave the country and I had a car there, for example. I wanted to transfer it back to Europe. Yeah. That's not easy. That's a bit of a pain to go through. You have to, so I had to call with a bank to transfer some like that. It's not easy. At some point, it was actually getting so annoying and so difficult that I considered looking into a cryptocurrency to do that. But then I thankfully got through to the bank and they made the transaction happen. But that I think there are many, many innovations going on also in the normal financial space, making international transactions easier. But, you know, for many people, it's still a very costly and tricky, difficult thing to do.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Okay, excellent. Let's see if there's one last question, and then I think we can conclude. I have one question here from Ivars, which is, I don't fully understand the question myself, but you hopefully will. Is any bridges for LQTY token on other chain? So could it be used as collateral?
Okay, yeah. So I think, so a bridge is basically something that connects different blockchains or connects like different layers of a blockchain. It is bridged to some other layers. So there's a bridge to Optimism. I think there's one for Arbitrum as well now. I'm not sure. And yeah, you can use it elsewhere. And I think most places, oftentimes you don't need a specialized bridge. It's just something, you know, if they allow transfer of this kind of ERC-20 standard token, you can either set the bridge up or just use their kind of generic bridge to take it over to different chains. So that's very, very doable.
Okay, one final question from Tony. Instability makes it an investment, I think referring to normal cryptocurrencies. Stability will make it a currency. I think that is referring to what stablecoins do. What will make this transition? I'm not entirely sure about how what Tony means with what will make this transition, but maybe he refers to you linking, like what you're doing is you're making this transition, because what you are doing is you take something which is volatile, Ether, and which is is more often considered an investment, I think, and you are issuing something which I think is closer to a currency because it's by design stable. It's not necessarily a great investment, or in the sense that you don't expect the price to skyrocket. So I guess, like, what is making this transition? Liquity is making this transition. Could you say that?
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah. You're kind of converting a risky asset to a stable one, but you're keeping your exposure to the investment asset.
Right, excellent. With that, I hope that that people have a good idea of what Liquity is about, what's happening a little bit in the crypto DeFi space, and how it links up to monetary economics. That is a big part of this channel. So Rick, thank you so much for talking to us, sharing your knowledge with us, answering these questions. And I wish you all the best with the Liquity project. And I really hope that at some point you will be able to link it more to the real economy, the lessons you learned here.
Yeah, for sure. I hope so too. And that's the plan. Yeah. Thank you very much. That was really a great chat and some great questions. Really fun.
Right. Thanks.